Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, April 5th. As you've been hearing on the news yesterday and today, perhaps the greatest moral horror of Putin's atrocity-filled war in Ukraine has been revealed in the city of Bucha, as videos have emerged of civilian corpses, many with their hands tied behind their backs, indicating execution-style killings, and as reports are documenting 150 to 300 bodies discovered now in mass graves, those victims having sometimes been shot in the backs of their heads, and the bodies sometimes partially burned. This is all leading to new pressure to help Ukraine more militarily as well as economically, and to not make territorial compromises so it doesn't look like these kinds of war crimes bring results. President Biden yesterday said this. You'll hear helicopter noise and wind in the background, but I think you can make out the words.
You may remember I got criticized for calling Putin a war criminal. Well, the truth of the matter is, so what happened in Bucha. This warrants him. He is a war criminal. But we have to gather the information. We have to continue to provide Ukraine with the weapons they need to continue the fight. And we have to gather all the detail so this can be an actual, have a war crime trial. This guy is brutal. And what's happening in Bucha is outrageous.
Outrageous, no doubt. But what does that mean the U.S. or other countries should do? U.S. military intervention often makes things worse. There's a fascinating article in Foreign Affairs magazine right now by its former editor, Gideon Rose, who is also author of the excellent book, How Wars End. Maybe you heard him on the media this weekend. He says, even as atrocities of civilians mount, Putin has failed to accomplish his main goals in Ukraine for reasons very similar to why the U.S. failed as badly as it did in its major wars of recent decades in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Vietnam. The article is called The Irony of Ukraine. We have met the enemy, and it is us. Gideon, thanks for coming on to discuss the moral questions raised by Bucha, but in the context of the big picture. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Always good to be here.
You start the article by saying a consensus has been forming about why Russia has failed to achieve its goals in Ukraine. What goals are you referring to, and what's that consensus as to why? Would you lay it out for us?
Well, the initial consensus among Western analysts on the war is that Putin thought that he could easily invade and take Ukraine, conquer it, put in a puppet government, and create a fait accompli that essentially would bring Ukraine back into the Russian fold and allow him to move forward in the world untrammeled and with an even greater and restored Russian empire. Unfortunately, his troops, from his perspective, things didn't go according to plan. The troops were not met as liberators, but as invaders. The Ukrainians didn't collapse, but put up a strong resistance. Zelensky didn't flee, but rallied his troops. And the West didn't cower, but rather came together and supported Ukraine, and Europe flipped its position. So now Russia's plan A, a quick, immediate war that would be successful and redound to its credit, went by the wayside in the first week or two. Then they turned to the Russian plan B, which was to sort of stand back and shell things and hope that by being more brutal and attacking civilian morale, you could achieve the same kind of goals, but with crushing the enemy's spirit rather than simply taking it away from them. That has managed to fail in the last couple of weeks as well. And so now you have a situation in which there is no plan C, really, and Russia is improvising as it is going forward. It seems that their latest plan is to try to retrench from the goal of taking all of Ukraine and concentrate on just parts of the east, and then say, well, that was all we wanted all along. But at this point right now, since their initial goals are being frustrated, everybody is trying to figure out what's going to happen next and how the war is going to end. And the reason this relates to the U.S. is it's not entirely dissimilar, however different the moral calculus, however different the motives, to the kind of situation the United States found itself in Vietnam from the late 1960s on and in Iraq and Afghanistan from the mid-2000s on, in the sense that Russia knows it's made a mistake, and now the question is, what happens next and how does it get out?
Talk more about that parallel to the United States, because you liken the Ukrainians today to the North Vietnamese communists, our enemy in the Vietnam War, or to the Taliban, our enemy in Afghanistan, of course. But we see them as bad guys and the Ukrainians as good guys. What's the parallel?
So Americans tend, not just Americans, to see themselves as the good guys and see war as an arena primarily of morality. And that is a key part of it. And what's going on in Ukraine is awful. But it is also a strategic situation which has certain common features with other strategic situations, and the logic imposes itself on the belligerents. And so it has a lot in common with other wars. For example, it's a limited war in the nuclear age, and it's highly unlikely to escalate to the nuclear level because both superpowers know that they shouldn't actually do that. And there have been a lot of wars in which they've kept fighting at the conventional level. But it's also a situation in which the Russians are playing the role of the outside invading conqueror in what is essentially a kind of imperial or colonial war. And although we don't think of ourselves as doing that, because we think of ourselves as backing good causes and friendly Democrats in various places, we've often been in a structurally similar situation. We took over from the French in Vietnam, for example, and even though we didn't want to keep the colony the way they did, we were on the same functional position in fighting a nationalist resistance. In both Iraq and Afghanistan, we were the external power trying to conquer and pacify the country and ultimately being unable to do so. And so this idea of us being on the attacker side in the past, it should give us insights into what Russia is thinking strategically, at least, and it should give us insights into how to fight the war, because we're in the position now of, let's say, Iran when the United States was in Iraq, of Pakistan when the United States was in Afghanistan, of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, China and Russia when the United States was stuck in Vietnam. We are now helping the Ukrainians resist the invasion of the Russians and make any kind of occupation a non-starter.
Another parallel that you draw is between the U.S. in this war and Iran in the Iraq War and Pakistan in the Afghanistan war. Of course, in those cases, the U.S. was seen as the big imperial power that Russia is seen as now. In what ways are we like Iran with respect to Iraq, or Pakistan with respect to Afghanistan?
So we're helping the Ukrainians resist. We're not the direct belligerent in this war. It's obviously Russia and Ukraine. But we are aiding Ukraine across the border, providing supplies, helping the resistance. That is the kind of thing that the Iranians did when we were in Iraq, providing help to the militias. It's the kind of thing that the Pakistanis did in helping the Taliban and providing safe haven and sanctuaries. We have been bedeviled by sanctuaries in foreign countries next to the insurgencies we've been fighting for half a century. Now we're in that role, supplying a proto-insurgency and for right now, the resistance in the West for Ukraine. And that means what we're essentially trying to do is play defense and exhaust the attacking, conquering power. And that's a different role than playing offense and being the one controlling the operation.
Bruce in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC with Gideon Rose from the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of How Wars End. Hi, Bruce.
How are you guys?
Great, thanks.
We're doing all right, under the circumstances. What you got for us, Bruce?
Yes, the circumstances are crazy. I actually just got out of Ukraine on like the 26th, and it's a bad situation. So my main call is there's a lot of aid that people are going to Ukraine. We have an aid site. But in the framework that you're talking, most people have never lived in Ukraine. Most people have never lived in Moscow, don't speak the language, don't know the cultures of both regions. So when they're talking about aid or they're talking about military actions, it's always from that American framework, which is different. So now in Odessa, you have people waiting for aid. They're not getting that aid. there's different ways where aid needs to get into the country, but because people don't live there and don't know, people aren't getting aid. That needs to change. So, but you do have groups that are working to get aid there, and you have aid where you have sites online where you can give direct to the military, but the people actually need money now. We have people in a hotel right now with staff and families, and the food is running out. They're not getting the aid that's coming. I'm raising money, trying to get money from everyone for them. So that was just my point.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, given your experience there, people should know about how to get the aid in or how to get the people out?
Yes. But the problem is, I taught in Ukraine too. I'm a former lawyer, so I taught in the law schools. A lot of my students now are reporters with Ukraine. It's information. And then this key and this thing that's going on now with the war, there's an information warfare. So you need to know the correct channels, the correct people to get the correct information. And that's the problem. I have people, military calling me directly where they need certain equipment. Now, they're sending money from Ukraine here to get that. So now because I've been there, so now we're making arrangements for me to get it there. So I know they're going to get it. So where it's not going to be someplace sitting. And they're not going to see that.
Uh-huh. What's your connection to Ukraine, if you're free to say?
I went to Ukraine years ago. I was in the revolution in 2014 with my Don, too, in Odessa. It was a little different then. So then, now I have a daughter. So I have family there. I have property there, do business there. So, and I'm African-American. So when you see the stuff on the news and they talk about the discrimination crossing the borders, and to Poland, to Romania, and Moldova, or even in Ukraine, that stuff is true. So in this case, we're now even trying to raise money where I have issues with African-Americans or people of color. Say, no, we're not going to give because of the discrimination. And I said, listen, this situation is bigger. People are dying. And I said, even the same people you don't want to help, they have mixed Ukrainian families. So guess what? They need money, too, when they get in Poland or when they get in Germany. When they get in Romania to survive, it's a tough situation. Yeah, what the gentleman said as far as the mindset and the political, even Putin himself. I lived in Moscow.
Uh-huh.
I know in Moscow you can protest all day. That doesn't change nothing. Life goes on. People disappear. But most Americans don't know that, or Ukraine because they've never been there, or they visited for a week or two on vacation. That's not knowing anything about a country. You have to live there, speak the language, know the people, work, and et cetera.
Bruce, thank you so much for your call. Please call us again. Beth in Princeton, you're on WNYC with Gideon Rose. Hi, Beth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm very curious about Zelensky's strategy of asking daily for a couple of weeks at least for a no-fly zone. Did he think he was going to get that ever, or was that a PR strategy for his country and also a negotiation tactic?
Interesting question, Gideon.
So, you know, in the fall of Afghanistan, when the Ashraf Ghani government sort of collapsed and the leader sort of bugged out in the middle of the night, we saw sort of the worst case scenario of what happens when your client sort of falls apart under pressure. And in Ukraine, with Zelensky's charismatic resistance, we're literally seeing the exact opposite. The best case scenario of when your local ally sort of stays in place and responds and rises to the occasion rather than falling away. The hand that Zelensky is playing is a weak hand, obviously, and he's playing it incredibly well. He's obviously made himself one of the major leaders of our time, even from such an embattled position. But the role of the client in this situation is also a pretty standard role, and it's to ask for as much as you can from the great power, because this may be an optional war for Putin. It may be an optional war for the United States. It is not optional for Zelensky. For Zelensky, it's a total existential war, and he is desperate to get whatever help he can. And so his strategy is to ask and ask and ask, browbeat, play up anything that can happen, and hope that he can leverage his charisma and his appeals to get more help.
Mm.
And the question is, at what point, and the only thing we need to be careful of is whenever we have a charismatic small ally that we feel emotionally bound to, whether it's Taiwan, whether it's Israel, whether it's in this case, Ukraine, there is a tendency to assume that the interests of Washington or the United States are unanimous and identical with the interests of the local client. And that's not necessarily the case. So as much as we are on the Ukrainian side, and as much as we need to punish and contain Russia, we need to be careful to recognize that U.S. interests and the interests of the Zelensky government are overlapping in some situations, but not identical.
Here are some tweets coming in. One listener writes, listening to you now talk about how we should not rub Putin's nose in his depravity, and I'm disgusted hearing this. Enough coddling. Another asks, does Mr. Rose know if and how much opposition media the Russian people get exposed to? Anything respected or powerful? And related to that, somebody else writes, can the U.S. break into the Russian communication system and tell them the truth? Russian mothers have to know sons are dying.
So can the U.S. break into the Russian information system and tell them the truth? I kind of see the Brian Lehrer show as an attempt to break into the U.S. information system and tell Americans the truth. And we don't seem to be doing a particularly good
job.
Now
you're coddling.
I think it's very serious. One of the things we need to be very careful about is in the heat of war, not to lose sight of how things look to other people and how we ourselves have seen. The United States is posing as this great avatar of democracy and freedom of the press and sanity and rationality and goodness. And in this case, that's certainly true. Compared to the other side of this war, all that is completely correct. But from the rest of the world's perspective, America has not always been this innocent, is still deeply flawed in many respects, commits mass atrocities itself, but then always excuses them as, oh, it was a mistake, or, oh, it was collateral damage. It's not that Russia isn't committing atrocities in Ukraine. It absolutely is. But other countries look at us and go, you guys are hypocritical because you kill civilians whenever it benefits you. You just don't like to acknowledge it that way. You categorize it differently. You talk about it and you minimize it. And now you Americans are taking the opportunity to make a big deal of Russia stuff for political reasons, not moral reasons. And I think there's a kind of, that's why it's very, you need to be very careful. What is going on is embedded in a strategic context, and we need to be careful to link our feelings and our passions to ultimately a policy that will help achieve the least bad outcome at the end of the day.
Here's another one criticizing what you said about finding a way to let Putin make it seem like he's walking away from this war voluntarily. Writer says, the problem with your guest not wanting to name Putin accurately as a war criminal, it is necessary to call him what he is. These days, if you don't name it, it allows the, quote, other side to have a say and muddy the waters. Haven't we learned this with the 2016 campaign? So you could respond to that in context of the 2016 campaign and, you know, both sidesism and false equivalency in the discourse in the United States, but also maybe the fact that we got a few tweets like this now are an indication that people don't want to hear pragmatic diplomacy solutions right now when the moral atrocities being committed are just so great.
So the fact is that this war is only going to end when the Russian leadership makes a conscious choice to withdraw and retrench. That is the only, or the Ukrainian government collapses and we move to some kind of insurgency in which we continue the fighting, but from underneath. And if you think of it in this perspective, then the question becomes, how do you get the Russians to do that? Now, clearly, frustrating their actions on the ground is a crucial part of that. We should be giving all the aid and all the conventional military help we can, short of the nuclear firebreak and short of getting our forces directly involved and frustrating their operations. But even that doesn't necessarily mean they will immediately withdraw. We were frustrated in Vietnam for years. We were frustrated in Iraq for years. We were frustrated in Afghanistan for years. They were frustrated in Afghanistan for years. Something has to happen after the frustration to get you to accept it and walk away. And that is a psychological question on the other side. And if you ask yourself, does humiliation help you give in to accept a reality that when you know you've done something wrong, does it help to basically anathematize you in public? Or does that make you resist even what you know you should do just to screw the other guy who's yelling at you? Essentially, we shouldn't write checks that we can't cash with our words, and we should keep our goals to practical, specific goals, pushing Russia back and out, and use our actions in a coordinated strategy to try to achieve that.
Josh in Brooklyn wants to question your comparison between the U.S. in Vietnam and Russia here in Ukraine. Josh, you're on WNYC with Gideon Rose from Foreign Affairs. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to disagree with your guest's comparison to previous American interventions, especially Vietnam. I think there are two issues. One is that whether or not it was misguided, Vietnam was an ideological war. It was the U.S. was fighting for against communism and what they thought was the domino theory. The other big difference is Russia is the Russian invasion of Ukraine is a one-man war. If it weren't for Putin, there would be no war there. It's not a war of a nation against a nation. It's a war of one psychopath trying to build an empire. I'll take the answer off the phone. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
So I think that's I agree with both of those points. But the first one, although there are lots of differences between the wars and lots of differences between the motivations involved, I don't think it changes the strategic calculus. So, for example, the French were trying to protect a colony in Vietnam. We were trying to stop the spread of communism. Both of us bumped up against the problems of maintaining an outside government in a country that had a nationalist resistance that didn't want us there. And in with regard to the Putin himself, as the war has run into trouble, yes, he dominates the regime, but the greater discontent around him and the loss of Russian capabilities is creating a context in which his thinking might change. And if you ask yourself about how many people in the U.S. were actually involved in the launching of the Iraq War in 2003, it was more than George W. Bush, but it wasn't all that many more. And it certainly wasn't a mass popular or democratic movement with a clear plan of action for the end. So the notion of a small group of people having wishful thoughts about what might happen and launching a war without really figuring out what will happen if their initial plans don't work is something that in its broad outlines we should be familiar with. And that's why I say we should look at the enemy and see it's at least some of our own self in the reflective mirror.
For now, we leave that there. Gideon Rose's article in Foreign Affairs is called The Irony of Ukraine. We have met the enemy, and it is us. Thank you so much for discussing it with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.